Good morning and welcome to Sunstone. We are thrilled to open this conference a day after Pioneer Day. This is session 111, titled Rethinking Pioneer Day. I am Joe Overton. I am an enrolled tribal member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, known by the federal government by that name. We call ourselves the Si-Changu Lakota. And so, and that's true of pretty much every tribe. So as Lindsay asked me to, I'm nervous, sorry. But Lindsay asked me to do this, and Lindsay and I kind of have a history about rethinking Pioneer Day and talking about Native history and rights. And as a step towards honoring the truth and achieving healing and reconciliation, Sunstone commits to open all public events and gatherings with a statement acknowledging the traditional Native lands on which we stand. Such statements become truly meaningful when coupled with authentic relationships and sustained commitment. We therefore commit to moving beyond words into programs and actions that fully embody a commitment to Indigenous rights and cultural equity. For more than 500 years, Native communities across the Americas have demonstrated resilience and resistance in the face of violent efforts to separate them from their land, their culture, and each other. And I'd like to add into that that most of the generation that's just above me were all forced into boarding school. It was the law. My aunt was kidnapped at the age of 4. She spoke only Lakota, but there the BIA had bounties for the children so that they could be forced to boarding school. So talk about violence, loss of culture. They remain at the forefront of movements to protect Mother Earth and the life it sustains. Today, corporate greed and federal policy push agendas to extract wealth from the earth and water rights. That's a big one. Degrading sacred land in blatant disregard of treaty rights. Acknowledgement is a critical public intervention, a necessary step towards honoring the Native communities and enacting a much larger project of decolonization and reconciliation. Because of this, we would like to recognize that the area that we sit on was first used by nomadic tribes and or bands, depending on their which they want to prefer to use. Paiute, Shoshone, Bannock Indians who roamed along the base of the mountains as they traveled from their winter home at Utah Lake to their summer fishing grounds at Bear Lake. Sorry. Before we introduce Professor Reef, we'd like to make a few announcements. The Sunstone Education Foundation is a 501c3 and depends on your generous donations. If you're in a place to do so, please consider making a donation and a contribution at the desk. You can support Sunstone by purchasing some of Sunstone's conference-themed merchandise, including lanyard pins of some of Sunstone's, say that three times fast, most esteemed scholars and other prominent figures in Mormonism. Audio for this session and others throughout the conference will be available for purchase at the Sunstone AV desk, also located in the concourse. This session will be done at 10 o'clock, and immediately at 10 o'clock, the air walls are going to close. So we are done. Please make sure anything that you have in the aisles is not in the way. We need to really be respectful of our next speakers that are coming in the next sessions. This conference has an official app. Look in your printed program for the instructions on how to download the Hoova app. It's really awesome. To get real-time updates for the conference, including copies of the sheet music, we want to thank Alan Eastman, our musician, and accomplished musician and being Sunstone's official pianist. We will start with the opening song. What? We switched it? Okay, go ahead. Oh, we're going to do the Spirit of God first. Is that correct? All right. We'll be singing the Spirit of God to the... And are we not doing a closing song?
We will.
Okay. Okay. We will also do a closing song, and it might be abbreviated. Look forward to knowing which song it is. I'm now going to introduce Paul. I left his book on my chair. Thank you kindly. I am now going to introduce Paul. W. Paul Reeve is the Simmons Professor of Mormon Studies in the History Department at the University of Utah, where he teaches courses on Utah history, Mormon history, and the history of the U.S. His book, he's also the president of the Mormon History Association this year. His book, Religion of a Different Color, Race and the Mormon Struggle for Whiteness, received the Mormon History Association's Best Book Award, the John Whitmer Historical Association's Smith Petit Best Book Award, and the Utah Historical Society Francis Armstrong Madsden Best History Book Award. And I'm sure they have this for sale, Paul?
Yes,
and it's for sale out there, and I would encourage you to buy it and read it. He is the recipient of the Utah Council for the Social Studies University Teacher of the Year Award, the University of Utah's Early Career Teaching Award, and the College of Humanities Ramona W. Cannon Award for Teaching Excellence in the Humanities. He is building a digital database, a century of Black Mormons, to name and identify all the known Black Mormons between 1830 and 1930. And we'd like to have Paul come up, and we'll enjoy his lecture.
So thank you to Joe for her kind introduction, and thank you for that music. On July 22nd, 2014, I received a brief email from Peggy Fletcher Stack, the award-winning religion reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune. Paul, I'm doing a short piece on Mormon pioneers for Thursday. Would you be willing to send me three surprising or intriguing facts about the pioneers and the trek that most people don't know? Considering the way in which... So in response, I sent Peggy the following paragraph. Considering the way in which some Pioneer Day talks in Mormon congregations sometimes conflate American patriotism with the Mormon arrival in the Salt Lake Valley, it seems evident that most Mormons today don't realize the depth of mistrust and resentment some Mormon pioneers harbored towards the United States in 1846 and 1847. When the Mormons arrived in the Great Basin, they were actually arriving in northern Mexico. They crossed an international border and were fleeing the United States. The U.S. war with Mexico was ongoing. Pioneer Hosea Stout, for example, wrote in his diary, quote, "I confess that I was glad to learn of war against the United States and was in hopes that it might never end until they were entirely destroyed, for they had driven us into the wilderness and was now laughing at our calamities." After Stack's story appeared in print and was subsequently passed around on Facebook, a bit of a dust-up ensued. A few people on Facebook wanted me to know that their Mormon pioneer ancestors were loyal Americans, and that I and that I had done them a disservice in the way that I had characterized the mistrust and resentment that some pioneers harbored towards the United States. It was an indication to me of how well Mormons have made themselves over into apple pie eating, baseball playing, flag waving Uber Americans. The transformation is remarkable. So much so that many Pioneer Day celebrations in the 21st century do not hesitate to conflate American patriotism with Mormon pioneer veneration and insist that they are one and the same and always have been. We can take the community in which I live as an example. I've not done an empirical study of Pioneer Day celebrations throughout the state. I'm a historian of the past, not an anthropologist or sociologist. But I live in Bountiful, Utah. Bountiful may or may not be a representative example of all Pioneer Day celebrations. Even still, I have lived in Utah most of my life, and I do observe and participate in Mormon culture, so I am fairly comfortable using it as an example, even while I don't suggest that it should be used as the example. These are just some of the images that I encountered this week. So I took some pictures on my morning run. These are the banners that are placed around Bountiful. And you can notice then the imagery, and it's not difficult to appreciate then that red, white, and blue are the colors being used in the banners and the emblems. And you have deconstructed American flags as a part of the symbolism bound up in Bountiful Handcart Days. That's the official name for the Pioneer Days celebration in my community. So also on July 24th this year, I just drove through several neighborhoods in Bountiful, and you'll notice then the flag-lined streets in the neighborhoods in the community in which I live. So that's just an example of the ways in which American patriotism gets conflated with Pioneer Day in the 21st century. The interesting thing then is that since Peggy Fletcher Stack's article appeared 4 years ago, the LGS Church History Department released the Council of 50 Minutes. After now having read those minutes, if I had to answer Stack's request today, I would suggest that my original answer, if anything, understated the mistrust and resentment some Mormons bore towards the United States. I would amplify the degree and depth of mistrust and even outright rejection of the United States and its Constitution that animated the Council of 50's attitude. And I'll just share with you just some examples. So obviously, before his murder, Joseph Smith actually suggests to the council that they write their own constitution, that the U.S. Constitution had failed the Mormons. It had failed to protect minority rights. And remember, there was not a 14th Amendment to the Constitution at that point. And so that is emblematic of the amount of distrust that the Mormons were harboring of the government. So just some examples from the Council of 50 Minutes. Council members spoke very warmly about forming a constitution which shall be according to the mind of God and erect it between the heavens and the earth where all nations might flow into it. W.W. Phelps said in one council meeting he was in favor of letting the United States and the British government alone. We are better without them. Joseph Smith said, we have a right to complain of the government until they redress our wrongs. W.W. Phelps said, the boasted freedom of these United States is gone, gone to hell, where they, the mobbers, will all go if they do not repent. So just examples in the Council of 50 Minutes of some of the lingering resentment that the Mormons have. And after Joseph and Hiram Smith's martyrdom, these kind of sentiments increase and accelerate. So that gives us an indication of the ways in which the Mormons, as they arrive in northern Mexico, are harboring those kind of resentments. So then, how is it that this patriotism comes to be conflated with the Mormon arrival in the Salt Lake Valley? Well, we can take a snapshot in time and get an indication of what Pioneer Day celebration looked like on the 24th of July, 1880. There's a publication called the Utah Pioneers where they print the events of that year, and it gives us some sort of indication of 33 years after the arrival, how they're feeling about things. And there's already this veneration that the 24th of July is very important. So just some excerpts from this Pioneer pamphlet on the 24th of July, 1880. The entrance of the pioneers into Great Salt Lake Valley on the 24th of July, 1847, was an event that should be commemorated forever. It was not only of vast importance to the people of whom the pioneers were the advance guard, but directly to the nation and, incidentally, to the whole world. To the Latter-day Saints, it is a day of days. It marks a turning point in their history. Up to that time, their path was crimsoned with the blood of their martyrs and made lurid by the fire of their burning homes. Houseless and friendless, they were driven from the confines of civilization and left to perish by the hands of savages on the border of the great American desert. And another excerpt gives us an indication then that they were at least 33 years later still aware that they had arrived in Mexico. That memory disappears in the 20th century. All people who were not blinded by prejudice and partisan bias might consistently join with us in celebrating the day we honor. The hard pioneers came upon Mexican soil as American citizens. Now, this next part I read as aspiration. Remember, in 1880, they are still fighting tension with the federal government and about to go into a decade of harsh federal crackdown. So any sort of notions of American patriotism is aspirational. Please accept us and see us as American at the same time that the government is branding Mormons as un-American. The hired pioneers came upon Mexican soil as American citizens whose brothers and sons, 500 in number, were serving in the Mexican War. The stars and stripes were unfurled, and the nation that had withered its protection, withheld its protection when our rights were assailed, that had left us to perish and closed its ears to our cries, was still honored and its constitution venerated. So once again, I think those sentiments are aspirational, hoping that the nation will adhere to the notion that they were, in fact, Americans as they were arriving in northern Mexico. So Lindsay asked me to help us rethink Pioneer Day. What I'd like to do is just offer three ways in which, first of all, we can pull back on the ways in which the pioneer arrival has become mythologized, and then be more inclusive of our vision of what Pioneer Day might mean. So we'll talk through first the Mormon Exodus and the ways in which it's become mythologized, and then think about ways we might include other peoples in this type of narrative. So sometimes the Mormon narrative goes something like this. The Mormons wander aimlessly westward, not knowing in advance where they're going, and arriving on July 24th, and Brigham Young rises from his sick bed and looks over the Salt Lake Valley, has a heavenly manifestation, and concludes this is the right place. And at that moment, they know where they are going. That sort of violates even revelatory notions of seeking divine guidance that Joseph Smith had enunciated. Study it out in your mind first. And so the historical reality was that they, in fact, did study it out in their minds. And so we know that the Mormon migration westward is a part of the broader westward migration to Oregon and California and then a stream to Utah. Even though it's a part of this broader migration, it differs in four important ways. The Mormon migration was a cooperative mass movement of a whole people and culture. If you're going to Oregon and California, you're not moving 12,000 people, a whole people and culture. You're maybe moving with some neighbors and people from your community and organizing a migrant group, but not a mass migration of a whole people and culture. It was a forced migration, especially if we talk about the 46-47 migration. Those who are going to Oregon and California are doing so by choice. And Mormons were poorer than the other westward migrants. Historians refer to the westward migration as a middling migration or a middle-class migration. You actually have to have money to move across the country. It's no different in the 19th century than it is in the 21st century. It takes money to move. Those who are poor couldn't afford to do so. Those who are wealthy were satisfied with their lot in life and didn't want to move. And so it's largely a middle-class migration. The Mormons are the exception. They are the poorest of the poor on the Overland Trail. And then the other way in which they differ is simply that the Mormons had as extensive a knowledge of the land beyond the Rocky Mountains as was available in the maps and books of the period. They're not wandering aimlessly. And especially with the publication of the Council of 50 Minutes, we know that they have zeroed in on the Salt Lake Valley as early as September of 1845. So just some evidence of their foreknowledge of the West. From 1844 to 46, Brigham Young devoted considerable time to studying available maps and published works of the West. The Nauvoo Neighbor, one of the newspapers published in Nauvoo, regularly published articles on the West. The Neighbor published excerpts from Lansford Hastings' Immigrant's Guide to Oregon and California. And in January, March, and September of 1845, the neighbor quoted portions of John C. Fremont's report of the region and emphasized Salt Lake Valley. I'll just give you one example. In September of 1845, the neighbor concluded, quote, "The Great Salt Lake, one of the wonders of nature and perhaps without rival in the world, being a saturated solution of salt of 100 miles in diameter, is for the first time revealed to our view. Of the geographical discoveries and descriptions, the most striking is that of the Great Basin, or vast interior plain, which lies between the Sierra Nevada and Rocky Mountains, east and west, a basin which may hold such a kingdom as France." They're thinking about moving an entire group and culture and people, and man, this location may hold a kingdom as large as France, and which has for its rim a circle of mountains whose summits penetrate the regions of eternal snow, is certainly a new and grand object to be revealed. And we know now from the Council of 50 Minutes that probably no coincidence that that's published in the Neighbor in September of 1845, because the Council minutes tell us that on the 9th of September, 1845, Brigham Young stated that it has been proved that there is not much difficulty in sending people beyond the mountains. We have designed sending them somewhere near the Great Salt Lake, September of 1845. And we also know why the Mormons are thinking about this region. There had been questions, are they aware they're crossing an international border? In fact, the Council of 50 Minutes substantiate that, yes, they are aware, and they are very much interested in a location outside of firm state control. When they are in the bounds of the United States, they have tension with the federal government. They want a place where organized governments are going to leave them alone. And Erastus Snow articulates this idea on the 22nd of March, 1845. This is William Clayton's summary of Erastus Snow's remarks. "The only difficulty there appears to be in the way of our locating in California." And California, remember, as a state, did not exist. It's talking about a broader geographic region that would have included the Great Basin or Alta California, the entire region. So the only difficulty there is the Mexican government. And he, Erastus Snow, has no fears about them. He knows the Mexican government is weak, and they have never taken measures to place themselves in a situation of defense. They are too weak to maintain themselves against their own enemies in their midst. Every information he has been able to get goes to satisfy him that there is a mere form of government, but not much power. So Mormons have zeroed in on this region because they see it as outside of the bounds of firm state control in a place where they can establish their godly kingdom, hopefully without interference from the Mexican government. Additional evidence of their foreknowledge, the weeks preceding the Mormon exodus from Nauvoo, the Nauvoo Temple becomes a site where they are studying maps and reading John C. Fremont's journals and continuing to gain as much information and knowledge about what the West has to offer. So with that in mind, then, simply not true that they are wandering aimlessly. They are amongst the best prepared of those who are on the Overland Trail. Then the notion sometimes is that Mormons are trailblazers walking through a trackless wilderness. Remember, they're largely just following the Oregon Trail. It's been blazed for them. And then when they cut off from the Oregon Trail, they are benefiting from the disaster that preceded them the year before. Lansford Hastings had attracted four immigrant groups to come through the Salt Lake Valley in 1846. The last of those immigrant groups blazed the trail through Immigration Canyon, the Donner Party, and it's their difficulty in the Great Basin that costs them dearly time and accounts for their being trapped in the Sierra Nevadas. But they are blazing the route into the Salt Lake Valley that the Mormons would follow just 1 year later. So if there's any trailblazing that takes place, it's about a half mile around Donner Hill instead of over Donner Hill in Immigration Canyon. The Donner Party goes over Donner Hill. It's steep and costly in terms of time and exertion on their oxen, and Mormons actually blaze a trail about a half mile around Donner Hill. That's the only extent of trail blazing they actually have to do. Then there's been a long-standing controversy over what did Brigham Young say on July 24th. This is the place. Did he actually say that? And Or is that just a part of the way in which the story gets mythologized? I won't take the trouble to read these quotes. They might be familiar to you. The notion that he said those comes from Wilford Woodruff, who was present. Woodruff was driving the wagon that Brigham Young was in. And so as a historian then, you say, well, he was present. He's an eyewitness to these events. But his recording of those events is 33 years later in that celebration account that we quoted from before. And then later in his diary on July 24th, 1887, he repeats that. Wilford Woodruff's journal, 40 years ago today, I brought President Young into the valley of Great Salt Lake in my carriage. He was sick, but he began to mend from the hour he came into the valley. He had seen the valley before by vision, and when he looked upon it, he said it was the right place. Well, so that controversy continued to exist for quite some time. Recently, Jared Farmer found this interesting little tidbit in Levi Jackman's diary, July 28th, 1847, 4 days after the arrival of Brigham Young and the saints in the valley. And Levi Jackman writes, "The camp was called together to say where the city should be built. After a number had spoken on the subject, a vote was called for and unanimously agreed that this was the spot. After that, President Young said that he knew that this is the place. He knew it as soon as he came in sight of it, and he had seen this very spot before." That is a chronologically close retelling of what happened on July 24th. And the words, "this is the place," then captured in this July 28th diary entry. Maybe that will resolve the controversy over what was said, and we do have a state park, and that was never going to change whether or not Brigham Young said it or not. But nonetheless, you have a July 28th remembrance. The important thing that I think, or a July 28th diary entry where Brigham Young is actually saying this is the place, according to Levi Jackman. The important thing that we should consider, however, is the chronology of these events. July 24th is celebrated as the day Brigham Young arrives, but it's not the first day that Mormons arrive. And so once again, it should help us to think through the way in which these events get mythologized. Erastus Snow and Parley Pratt take a reconnaissance into the Salt Lake Valley on the 21st of July, 1847. They don't sleep over in the valley. They return to Immigration Canyon, but they're the first Mormon pioneers to enter the valley. And then the first encampment is July 22nd, 1847. There's a park there, 1700 South, 500 East, and then they turn and move farther north. By July 24th, when Brigham Young enters the valley, they're between present-day 3rd and 4th South and Main and State Streets. They have already plowed and planted and diverted City Creek. They are very much aware that they are stopping and settling. Whatever happens for Brigham Young, and historians can't confirm or reject otherworldly encounters, whatever happens for Brigham Young on the 24th of July seems a confirmation of a decision already made. Perhaps as early as September 1845, they were zeroed in on the Salt Lake Valley. And then going back to the Bountiful handcart days, we should also hopefully be aware that there were no Mormons pulling handcarts into the valley in July of 1847, even though my community calls it handcart days. Simply the focus, the hyper-focus on handcarts also leads to problems with the notion that the Mormon migration to the Great Basin was animated by high rates of death. So hopefully we're aware then that the Perpetual Emigrating Fund migration goes through four different phases, and the handcart phase by the 1990s starts to stand in for all other phases of Mormon migration. Handcarts start to stand in for all forms of Mormon migration, and the William Martin Company start to stand in for all other migrant groups. It's the least typical way of arriving in the valley. Only about 5% arrive via handcarts. 95% are going to arrive via some other means, but it grows out of all proportion to the point that in the 21st century, in a given week, over 3,000 Mormons will pull handcarts at the Martin's Cove location in Wyoming. More Mormons pulling handcarts in 1 week in the 21st century than pulled them in the 19th century combined. So it gives you an indication then of the way that this gets memorialized. And then that also, because the hyper-focus is on the Woolley and Martin companies, leads to notions of death rates disproportionate to what they actually were. There's a fabulous study of mortality on the Mormon Trail coming out of BYU led by Mel Bashore. I recommend it to all of you. It was published in BYU Studies. But it gives us an indication of death rates on the Overland Trail for the Mormons. Total number of deaths, 1,910, gives a death rate of 3.41% compared to a U.S. annual mortality rate during the same time period of approximately 2.5% to 2.9%. You are increasing your chances of dying by less than a percentage point if you immigrate to the Great Basin. And if you throw in then the handcart migration does have a higher death rate. You have to extract out the Woolley and Martin groups because they are an anomaly. So Woolley and Martin groups suffered a mortality rate of 16.5%. If you pull them out, then the mortality rates for all the other handcart companies is about 4.5%. So it is statistically higher than the mortality rates of the wagon train companies at 3.4%, but still not drastically higher. And of those 1,910 deaths, less than 20% of those deaths report a cause. Of those reported, over 50% list cholera or diarrhea as a cause of death. Other causes included run over by a wagon, stampeded, consumption, drowned, fever, and accidentally shot. 4 deaths were reported from Indians. 2 people were eaten by wolves. 2 deaths from a poisonous bite or scorpion sting, and 1 murder. The other way in which Pioneer Day gets remembered in the 20th and 21st centuries is as a white Mormon migration and seems to collectively erase from memory the black pioneers who also arrived with the Mormons and also erases the notion that some of those were actually black slaves. In 1897, the Brigham Young Monument includes this plaque, and in the far corner, you see a line drawn, and it does acknowledge then 3 quote-unquote colored servants, Green Flake, Harclay, and Oscar Crosby, as a part of that July 24th entrance into the Salt Lake Valley. And in the 19th century, the African-American pioneers were not forgotten. They were commemorated and celebrated. This is the 1905 July 24th commemoration, and it includes Jane Manning James and her brother Isaac Manning. And Green Flake, who was a slave who entered the Salt Lake Valley, was also frequently included in July 24th celebrations. Found over 30 newspaper articles on July 24th that mentioned Green Flake. He was frequently featured as a speaker, and one of these articles here in Fort Union, it lists Green Flake as one of the speakers for their July 24th celebration. By the 20th and 21st century, then, those African-American saints and the fact that some of them were actually slaves and Mormons have been erased from collective Mormon memory. I'll just share one of those with you. John Burton, born as a slave in 1797 in Virginia, and at some point becomes the property of a white slave master named John Burton. John Burton, the white slave master, marries Susan McCord in Missouri, and John Burton, the white slave master, John Burton, the black slave, and Susan McCord will join Mormonism, 1833 perhaps, in Missouri. John Burton, the white slave master, dies in 1838. Susan McCord, John Burton, the black slave, and the children immigrates to Nauvoo. Susan McCord becomes a plural wife of Joseph Lee Robinson in Nauvoo, and the first time John Burton ends up in Joseph Lee Robinson's journal is as they are fleeing Nauvoo, headed to winter quarters. And this is the diary entry. We got along quite well, but had some afflictions. Our little daughter Anna Maria was crippled in one of her legs, and one of Brother Johnson's little boys came down with the measles. And one of my drivers, a colored man, a member of the church, which was the property of my second wife, a good and faithful man, while yoking a cow one morning, hurt his knee, and he became a cripple. So we had two cripples, which made it very hard on me, but the Lord helped us, and we kept along. Our cripples soon got better of their lameness." John Burton then shows up in the records at winter quarters. He is given tithing credit for digging a grave for a fellow Latter-day Saint. He's listed in the census at winter quarters in the 7th Ward as a colored man living next to Green Flake, another black slave at winter quarters. He is an 1847 pioneer into the Salt Lake Valley, and when Joseph Lee Robinson and Susan McCord are sent to help settle Parowan, John Burton goes with them. This is the 1850 census, listing John Burton as a pioneer settler of Parowan, Utah. And in 1861, when Parowan decides to build its first proper church, the clerk is sent throughout the community to collect donations. And John Burton then is listed amongst those who give money to building the first church in Parowan. And you'll notice in parentheses the word African next to his name, and he contributes $15 to the building of the church in Parowan. He dies in 1865 and is buried in Parowan, Utah. Born a slave, 1797 in Virginia, buried 1865 in Parowan, Utah. He's a part of the pioneer heritage and a black slave. The other way in which we need to rethink, obviously, Pioneer Day is the ways in which Mormon colonization of Native American land and people leads to profound displacement and the loss of life. Native American groups controlled 100% of the land base that we call Utah before the Mormons arrive. By the beginning of the 20th century, that had been reduced to 4% of the land base. And a population loss of around 90%, from anywhere from 12 to 20,000 down to about 2,600 by the turn of the 20th century. So what Mormons celebrate as their arrival as religious refugees begins the displacement and the creation of new refugees. This happens everywhere Euro-Americans go, and Utah is no different. And we should be aware then that it's not just disease, but in fact, sometimes military action. Most people are aware, if they are aware at all, of a policy coming from Brigham Young. It's that he says it's cheaper to feed than to fight them. They're not aware that he arrives at that conclusion by 1851 and 1852 because he tried fighting them first. And the conclusion is born of experience. And so he offers a selective, or orders a selective extermination of Timpanogos Utes in Utah County. Estimates are from 40 to 102 Utes are killed, and one Mormon is killed in that process. And there is a government explorer in the region and a surgeon with that government explorer, and the surgeon is interested in collecting the skulls. It's a part of the era of phrenology and skull study, and he wants to send them back to Washington, D.C. for study. So he gets a couple of Mormons to come and help him after this death, and so Abner Blackburn records this experience in his journal. "A few days after the last battle with the Indians, a government surgeon wanted James Orr and me to take a sleigh and cross over on the ice and secure the Indians' heads, for he wanted to send them to Washington to a medical institution. We hired a sleigh and crossed over on the ice. The weather was bitter cold. The surgeon took out his box of instruments and commenced. It took him a quarter of an hour to cut off one head. The sun was getting low and freezing cold. Jim and me took the job in our own hands. We were not going to wait on the surgeon's slow motion. Jerked our knives out and had them all off in a few minutes. They were frozen and come off easy in our fashion. The surgeon stood back and watched us finish the job." So we have to stop and consider then the use of the language of savages. Who are the savages in these kind of situations? And so when Brigham Young arrives by late 1851, early 1852, at his policy that it's cheaper to feed them than to fight them, it's because Mormons have tried fighting them. And it's born of experience that they conclude it is cheaper then to feed them than to fight them. That doesn't mean that there weren't other interactions with Native Americans of a violent nature. When Mormons attempt to stem and cut off the slave trade that Wakara, the leader of the Utes, had been participating in prior to the Mormon arrival, it will erupt into the Waka War, and then you will have later, because the Mormons continue to encroach on Native American lands, the Black Hawk War for the Utes. For the Shoshone, you have the Bear River Massacre, which takes place on January 29th, 1863. And Patrick Connor, the leader of forces stationed at Camp Douglas, leads in this massacre. He claims that his troops killed 224 warriors, but in 1911, Danish immigrant Hans Jaspersen claimed to have walked across the battlefield and counted the dead bodies. He said he counted 493 dead Shoshone, making it the largest Native American massacre in American history. And it's a tragic byproduct of Mormon settlement and colonization. It's led by troops stationed at Camp Douglas, but nonetheless, these are the ramifications of Mormon colonization. The Navajo are rounded up and taken to Bosque Redondo in what comes to be called the Long Walk, finally allowed to return, and created a reservation was created for them and their traditional lands. And then for the Southern Paiute and the Goshute, the Skull Valley Band, there are reservations created piecemeal of the last half of the 19th century. So is it any wonder that the current leader of the Northwest Band of Shoshone tweeted, "I am renaming Pioneer Day to Manifest Destiny Day." And Darren Perry is with us today. And obviously, we need to understand what Pioneer Day looks like from a Native American perspective, and that's one indication from a current tribal chief. So with that said, then, let me just conclude. What does all of this mean? It is impossible to participate in Pioneer Day. Is it possible to participate in Pioneer Day, or should we protest instead? Or is there perhaps a more balanced middle ground? Mormon pioneers were, in fact, religious refugees when they arrived in the Salt Lake Valley in 1847. Because the story of their arrival sometimes gets mythologized and stretched does not mean that there is nothing worth commemorating. The 19th century communal aspect of Mormonism seems to have uniquely suited it to tackling the challenge of settling this portion of the West. Utah is the second driest state in the nation. Mormons accepted the challenge that that environment presented and through cooperative irrigation carved settlements. Brigham Young directed the founding of over 300 settlements, a feat unparalleled in American history. He oversaw the most successful organized mass migration in the American West as well. It was a concern for the poor and disadvantaged that led him to organize the PEF, which, combined with other forms of migration, facilitated the immigration of an estimated 55,000-year-old Americans to Utah before 1869. The Mormons banded together and worked hard to carve a Western Zion for themselves. Much of the Utah infrastructure that exists today was built upon the foundations that they established. All of that is true and worthy of respect, but that cannot be the only story we tell on Pioneer Day. If it is, then we are either ignorant of a more complex and messy history, or we are willing to ignore it. We might be better served by also thinking of Pioneer Day as a cautionary tale with lessons for the present and the future. As a cautionary tale, it teaches me that faith and fortitude are vulnerable and, when carried to zealous extremes, can lead God-fearing people to act beyond the bounds of reason. It also teaches me that about the intoxicating power of racism. White Mormon pioneers developed, taught, produced, and participated in racism aimed at their fellow Black Latter-day Saints. Some Black slaves were also Mormon pioneers. They were enslaved by their fellow Mormons. Pioneer commemorations need to grapple with the racism that produced that reality. The same goes for the inclusion of Native Americans. In reality, the relationship between Mormons and Indians in the Great Basin were frequently messy. Mormons baptized, married, ordained, murdered, indentured, befriended, fought with, traded with, fed, employed, warred against, and ultimately precipitated the displacement of Native Americans to reservations. The desert culture, the Fremont, the ancestral Puebloans, the Navajo, Southern Paiute, the Goshute, Shoshone, and Ute at one time or another have also claimed Utah as sacred space. This land is their homeland, their center, and the Utah dirt has significant meaning for them. Their death, marginalization, and relegation to reservations is a tragic result of Mormon settlement. Utah's native populations are still dealing with the effects of that dislocation today. So how can Rethinking Pioneer Day help? I want to return to where we started with some quotes from the Council of 50 Minutes. In those minutes, Joseph Smith compensated for the lack he saw in the U.S. Constitution by creating an expansive vision of religious freedom at Nauvoo and for his proposed kingdom of God on earth. Because he and his people experienced religious intolerance, it turned Smith into an ardent defender of religious liberty and of a pluralistic society. For Smith, it was not enough to merely tolerate people of other faiths or of no faith. Religious bigotry had no place in his worldview. God cannot save or damn a man only on the principle that every man acts, chooses, and worships for himself. Hence the importance of thrusting from us every spirit of bigotry and intolerance towards a man's religious sentiments, that spirit which has drenched the earth with blood. He called the council to witness that the principles of intolerance and bigotry never had a place in this kingdom, nor in my breast, and that he is even then ready to die rather than yield to such things. Nothing can reclaim the human mind from its ignorance, bigotry, and superstition, Smith insisted, but those grand and sublime principles of equal rights and universal freedom to all women and men. And I helped him out with the gender equality there. The most significant way to rethink Pioneer Day, then, is to turn the intolerance and religious prejudice of the past into tolerance and even benevolence for the present and the future. What if we replaced even a small degree of honor aimed at 19th century pioneers of all stripes with a large degree of empathy and understanding for 21st century pioneers who come to Utah also seeking refuge and hope for a better life? Utah has long been a cultural meeting and mixing ground. It seems to still be true today. 10 years ago, from July 2007 to July 2008, Utah became the fastest growing state in the nation. And although its rate of growth has slowed, it is still strong. This phenomenal growth, while good for Utah's economy, also means changes to Utah's society and environment. I believe that what Utah comes to mean in to these latest waves of newcomers, some of whom are refugees from violence and intolerance all their own, in part depends upon long-term residents like myself. I can see in Utah's past examples of injustice and discrimination, as well as evidence of friendship and concern that stretch beyond the bounds of religion and culture to include all peoples. It is then up to me to decide which path I will follow and how I will treat others. All of us face similar choices. Will we build walls of separation that divide Utahns into categories and stereotypes, or will we get to know each other as individuals, each of whom has the potential for good? It is my hope that Utah's pioneer history might serve as a catalyst for greater good, that as we rethink Pioneer Day, we might find somewhere in Utah's past a spark or two of inspiration for making a better present and a better future. Thank you.
Two minutes before the walls come down, so we'll just take like maybe one or two questions. Anybody? This gentleman.
Some years ago, I went to Bella Coola, British Columbia, and there was a great celebration there of the discovery of the Alexander Mackenzie expedition. And it seemed to be enjoyed by Native peoples there as much as by the white immigrants. What insight do you have about what seems to me to be a better way that the Canadian government interacted with Native Americans as opposed to what happened here in this country?
Yeah, I would say the insight that I have is that we should be listening to people like Joe and like Darren Perry, and we should allow them to teach us and learn from them ways in which their stories can be included. I would never pretend to speak for them, but would love to listen to them. And Darren, I'm going to put a plug in for what he's doing. The Northwest Band has now purchased the land where the Bear River Massacre took place, and he is raising funds to construct an interpretive center. So if you want to honor Pioneer Day, give money to Darren and help him build his interpretive center on the site where 450 Shoshone were massacred, right? And then let them tell us what this looks like from their perspective in that interpretive center that comes from the Northwest Band of Shoshone's perspective. That's one way that we can do it better.
You might have also mentioned the myth that they came to a desert. When they came into the valley, they thought it was really a verdant place and an ideal place to start a new life.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So all kinds of descriptions of the long grass, the abundant resources, this is a great place. The notion of only one tree, right, is one way in which that gets mythologized. And, you know, after they do plow and plant, right, they've turned, they made the desert blossom as a rose. They see sort of those self-fulfilling prophecies. But the notion of a vast barren wasteland doesn't exist in those initial journal and diary entries. They're enthusiastic. Not all of them. You know, there are some diaries that say, well, I'd travel another 1,000 miles to find a place that looks like we could live and sustain ourselves. But nonetheless, the notion coming from those diaries certainly substantiates the point that Bob is making. Yeah.
We'd like to give thanks to W. Paul Reeves for his discussion. And I'd also like to offer words of thanks. There were three people who have stayed up many hours stuffing our badges and cutting their fingers and making sure that everything was together for us. So I'd like to thank those who have been preparing Sunstone for us and our enjoyment.